to thank the organizer for the invitation and for preparing this interesting workshop. So I'm going to discuss a quite different topic now, which is related to dark energy. So the outline is the following. I will start with trying to give you some motivation for this work. And I will give you a kind of presentation which is based on ADM formulation, mention some link with the effective field theory approach to dark energy. And I will illustrate this formalism with a very large class of models which are called the Ordensky theories, which I will explain for those who don't know. And then I will try to make a brief link with observation. And my talk is mainly based on this work, which was published a couple of months ago. So let me try to give you some motivation about this work. So as you all know, the universe is presently accelerating. So of course, the simplest solution would be to assume that there exists a cosmological constant. But as you know, theorists don't like simple solutions. So there exist many models which try to explain this acceleration, and they are contained in the vast terminology of dark energy model. So in dark energy model, there are several types, but one can try to give two broad categories. So one type is to include an additional type of matter. So usually this is a scalar field, like in the quintessence or k-essence model. Another type of approach is to modify gravity. And when the situation becomes a bit complicated, it becomes difficult to make a clear transition between what is dark energy and modified gravity. So in some sense, it's better to have a global view of this subject. But anyway, the problem now is that we have many, many models. It's a bit like inflation. In inflation, we have many, many models. And the situation is very similar with dark energy. In the future, we can expect to have more and more data from cosmology. Especially, there will be some surveys of large-scale structure in the coming years, and especially a special mission, which will be Euclid, in about 10 years. So the goal of the work I'm going to present to you is to try to give a bridge between, on one side, you have many, many models, and on the other side, you have a large amount of data. So how to constrain the model, how to confront the model with the observations. So the idea is to give a kind of effective description which would help as a bridge between the models and the data. So you would not compare a given model to the data, but you would translate the model into this parameterized form, and then you could constrain the coefficients in the parameterized description with respect to the data. So this is the spirit of this approach. So here, my basic assumption will be the following. I will assume that I'm working with single scalar field models. So this is a restriction on what I'm going to present. I will also assume, but this is easy to relax, that all the matter, so I mean the baryonic matter, cold dark matter, etc., are coupled, minimally coupled to the same metric. So this part would be easy to relax. So the basic idea behind this approach is to use the ADM approach. So essentially, since you have a scalar field in the universe, this scalar field will define a preferred slicing. So here you have slices of uniform scalar field, where the scalar field is uniform. And then you can simply use an ADM approach, so a splitting of space-time into space and time, by using this preferred slicing. So the basic ingredients will be the following. Since you have a scalar field, you can take the gradient of the scalar field. And the gradient of the scalar field, if you renormalize it, will define a normal vector to the slicing. Then you can introduce a projector, which is here, which just projects everything on the slices. And then you have two natural tensors, which are going to describe the three-dimensional slices. So you have the intrinsic curvature intrinsic curvature tensor, this mu nu, the Ricci tensor. And you have the extrinsic curvature tensor, which is defined by this expression here. And now the idea will be to deal with a very generic action, which is simply built by using these building blocks here, by combining these tensors, the intrinsic curvature tensor and the extrinsic curvature tensor. So the generic action which I'm going to consider will depend on time, because we have a preferred slicing. Will depend also on the lapse function, which describe how the metric goes from one slice to the next slice, and then will depend on combination of the tensor. So of course you can take, for example, the trace of the extrinsic curvature tensor. You can take the square of this tensor. This will define the S quantity. You can take the trace of the intrinsic curvature, which will be given here. You can also take its square. And in principle, you can add many other type of combination of this type. Okay, but in the following, and you will see why, I'm going to concentrate on this combination here. Of course, you could, at the same level, you could imagine to introduce a dependence on the contraction with the Ricci tensor and the extrinsic curvature tensor, but it turns out that it can be reabsorbed and redefined in terms of the other quantities. So now, since I'm interested by cosmology, I'm going to I would like to make a splitting between what is the background, the homogeneous and isotropic evolution, and what will give the linear perturbation, the perturbations. So this is the splitting I'm going to do. So if you take, for example, the trace of the extrinsic curvature tensor, you know that in a strict Friedman-Robertson-Walker spacetime, this is equal to 3 times the Hubble parameter. So I'm just going to define a perturbed tensor, in some sense, or perturbed scalar in this case, which is k minus this background quantity. In the same way, I'm going to define a perturbed extrinsic curvature tensor, which is simply the difference between k mu nu and its value in a strictly Friedman-Robertson-Walker spacetime. So then if you take the square of k mu nu, you see immediately that it's very easy to decompose, and you will have 3 terms like this. Okay. So now I'm going to introduce this decomposition in my very generic Lagrangian, and I'm going to expand the Lagrangian up to first order to start with, which is the simplest operation to do. So this L bar is simply the homogeneous Lagrangian, and then it's just a Taylor expansion at first order, so it will depend on the derivative of L with respect to the lapse function, with respect to n, then it will depend on this coefficient f times delta k. So here you see immediately that there will be 2 contributions to this perturbation. One will come directly from the variation of L with respect to k, obviously. And the other one will come from the variation of L with respect to S, simply because S contains this delta k quantity here. So it's very basic Taylor expansion. So now I'm going to do a trick. So So just for convenience, but it's very useful when you do actual calculation, I'm going to get rid of this linear dependence in delta k. And to get rid of this linear dependence in delta k, I'm just going to do an integration by parts. So the idea is the following. So delta k is just k minus 3h. And then in the action, when I have f times k, k is simply the contraction of the covariant derivative with n, with the normal vector. So I'm just going to integrate by part by using the covariant derivative. So at the end, I have the covariant derivative which applies on f times n with a minus sign. And here I'm assuming by construction that f is only a time-dependent quantity. So it means that this quantity is non-zero only for the zero component. So I have a f dot here. And the n0 gives you a 1 over n, okay, where n is the lab function. So if I do this just substitution, I rewrite my first order expansion of the Lagrangian in this form here. Okay, so we have now I have these two extra terms here, which comes from this one and which comes from this one. I have also a new dependence in delta n, which comes from the f dot because of this. I have to perturb the 1 over n, and then the rest is the same. Okay, so this part was easy. So let's go now to the quadratic, to the second order expansion, because I will be interested by studying linear perturbations. So it's very easy as well, because this is a Taylor expansion when you go to the next order. So these are the new terms which appear here. Okay, which depends on all my quantities. So delta k mu nu, delta k mu nu, I have a delta n square, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, I define these coefficients. So here, a will depend on the second derivatives of the Lagrangian, so my very generic Lagrangian. And of course, because this is a delta k term, it will depend on the second derivative with respect to s and k, or to k, okay? Then I've also defined this b coefficient, which is here, and this c coefficient. And just to remember, this is my f coefficients. So you see, in this way, it's very easy, starting from a very generic Lagrangian. So my Lagrangian is supposed to include many types of model to derive, in a very simple way, the quadratic Lagrangian for the perturbations. So let's stop one minute to describe in this language how the Freeman equation are going to look like. So it's, once again, it's very simple. I introduce the homogeneous and isotropic metric. Here I keep explicitly the Laplace function because I want to obtain the Freeman equation, especially the constraint, the Hamiltonian constraint, by variation with respect to n. So I keep it explicitly. And then I just replace in the Lagrangian every quantity in terms of the homogeneous value, keeping the n everywhere. Okay. So now I just consider the perturbation of the action, of this action, with respect to my two quantities, which exist for the metric, which are n, the Laplace function, and the scale factor a. And I get this result. So from this, you read immediately the Freeman equation in this very generic, for this very generic Lagrangian. So far, I've not included matter here, but it's obvious to include matter. You just add the Lagrangian of matter, which by assumption here is minimally coupled to my metric. And you just perturb it to first order. So you introduce the t mu nu times the delta g mu nu. And it's going to give a contribution to delta n term and to the delta a cube term, which is simply the energy density here in this term and the pressure in this term. So in this way, you have a very, very general way to recover modified Freeman equation from a generic Lagrangian. So let's go back now to the quadratic Lagrangian. And to describe it in more details, I'm going to choose a specific gauge. So I'm going to choose a gauge such that the special metric is conformally flat. And the factor here, I will call it zeta. So it will be, in some sense, the curvature perturbation for the metric. The shift will be, so here I'm interested simply in scalar type perturbations. Okay, so my shift will be simply given by this psi. And then I can write down explicitly, going back, starting from my Lagrangian up to second order, in terms of this extrinsic curvature tensor and intrinsic curvature tensor, I can just compute explicitly these quantities in terms of this zeta and psi. And at the end, I will get a quadratic Lagrangian, which will be a function of zeta, of the perturbation zeta, of the perturbation of the lapse function delta n, and of my other perturbation, which is psi here. And it will appear only as a Laplacian of psi. So it looks rather messy, but here I'm going to extract terms which in the rest of the talk I'm going to get rid of, which are the terms in the Lagrangians which contains higher derivatives, higher special derivatives, so fourth order special derivatives. So because in the rest of the talk I will try to focus on linear perturbations which have a dispersion relation which scales like k square. I'm going to get rid of this term. So it could be, one could keep them, but in the rest of the talk, I will get rid of them. And you see immediately that to get rid of them, if you impose this condition, you just kill every of these terms. Okay. And one reason to get rid of this term is that the constraints are much simpler, and in particular, the momentum constraint. So if you start, when you have this Lagrangian, you can write down the Hamiltonian constraint by variation with respect to delta n. You can write down the momentum constraint by variation with respect to psi. And in this particular case, the momentum constraint becomes extremely simple and is given by this quantity. And the psi-dependent terms just disappear from the action. So then life is very simple. And I have this relation between delta n and zeta dot. Then I can substitute into the action. And I get an action which depends on my true single degree of freedom, which here is zeta. And this is the form of this quadratic action. So there is a kinetic term. And this kinetic term, you see, can be expressed in terms of all the derivatives of the initial generic Lagrangian. So essentially, it depends on the first and second derivatives of this Lagrangian, where D is defined like this. And my coefficient for the gradient terms is given by a similar expression. So here there is a time derivative because I'm using a integration by part at some point. So you see that from this generic expression, you can immediately, if you have a model, you can check immediately if your model has a ghost or not, just by looking at the sign of this quantity. So you can plug, you can compute this derivative of the Lagrangian, and you can check if you have a ghost or not. You can compute the effective speed of sound just by dividing these two expressions here. So just to illustrate in a very concrete example how it works, let's consider a very simple case, which is k-essence. So k-essence, this is k-essence is given by a Lagrangian, which is an arbitrary function of the scalar field phi and of the kinetic term of the scalar field, so x, this x quantity. So now I'm going to apply this formalism in the case where you have usual gravity, So you have an Einstein-Hilbert action plus this K-Sunstorm. So as you probably know, you can just rewrite the Ricci scala in an ADM form up to, there is a term which is a total derivative, so you can get rid of it. And so in an ADM form, this will be the square of the K mu nu minus K square plus the three-dimensional Ricci scala. And there you add this K sense Lagrangian. So now you have to remember that N is hidden in the X here. Because when you write down in the uniform scalar field slices, if you write down explicitly this X quantity, you see that you will have a G 0, 0 upstairs, which is going to give you this 1 over N square. So the N is here, and you have to be careful to keep it explicitly. So then now you can, it's very easy. You just compute all the quantities. So you compute the homogeneous Lagrangian. So it's very easy because this is a K mu nu, K mu nu. And K is 3H. So K mu nu is going to give you this 3H square. Here you have a minus 3H square, so it's minus h square, and r is 0. So you get this quantity for L bar. Then you just take the derivative with respect to n, to k, to s, and to r, and you get you can read them from the Lagrangian. And from if you plug this into this formula, so you also need the second derivative with respect to n, you get immediately the speed of sound, which is given by this. Okay, so it's a very easy way and powerful way to, if you start from a Lagrangian in ADM form, you can immediately derive all relevant quantities. So there is a close relation with the so-called effective field theory formalism, which was mentioned this morning by Alberto. So which was developed for inflation and which was later developed for dark energy as well. So in this language, you can write down a Lagrangian like a kind of expansion where the first three terms in blue correspond to the background, will give you the background evolution. So you can see that in the background evolution, you have three functions, which are the F, lambda, and C. So usually when you deal with inflation, you can just make a conformal transformation of the metric, so you can get rid of this function F. But here, I remind you that I've chosen the metric which is minimally coupled to matter. So I've not any freedom. I have no longer the freedom to make this conformal transformation. So I have to keep this F function. And the lambda and C functions can be just related to the evolution, the background evolution, which depends here on H and H dot. Okay, so these are these two functions here, lambda and C. And now you see immediately that one can have a kind of correspondence, a dictionary between the two expansions simply by rewriting the first term here in an ADM form. So this is the expression that I showed in the previous slide, plus this total derivative. But now you have to be careful because you have this F, so you cannot get rid of this. You have to take this into account. And the correspondence is also between the G not, which appears here, and the lapse function, which I introduced. So you see, it's very easy correspondence, and you can translate very easily between the two formalisms. So if you have a Lagrangian which is given in terms of this ADM form, you can just by computing the coefficients, so which means to compute the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to n, k, etc., you can compute very easily all these coefficients which appear in the EFT formalism. And I think the past people have to work a bit hard in a given model to find, to make expansion to find all these coefficients. So now I'm going to apply this formalism to the case of what are called the generalized Galilean, or also called the Hondensky theories. And so essentially this corresponds to the scalar field theories, which are at most second order for the equation of motions. So in fact, these theories were formed by Hondensky a long time ago and were rediscovered recently in the context of the Galilean. So let me give you a short summary of these theories. So essentially, they can be built from four elementary actions. So the first action, or the first Lagrangian, is simply the k-essence Lagrangian. So it's an arbitrary function of phi and x. Then you have the next Lagrangian will involve D'Alembertian of phi. So you see that in the Lagrangian, you have two derivatives which are acting on phi. But the magic of this series is when you write the equation of motion, you find that you have only up to two derivatives of the scalar field. Okay, so even if you have two derivatives in the action, when you write down explicitly the equation of motion, at the end you have only at most two derivatives. So this is for the second one. So the third one is a bit more complicated. So now you have a square of D'Alembertian and this term. And now you have to introduce this Ricci scalar. And the reason is that you want not only the equation of motion of the scalar field to be at most second order, but you also want the Einstein equation to be at most second order. So you have to take into account the fact that the covariant derivative don't commute in general, and so you have to include in the action terms which depends on the curvature tensor. So this is for the third one, and the last one, which is the most complicated, involves the Einstein tensor here. Okay, so now if I want to apply this, my formalism, I need to translate these actions into an ADM form. So this is what I'm going to do now. And at the end of the day, I will be able to identify all the coefficients which appear in the quadratic Lagrangian, for example, or which appear in the EFT Lagrangian in a very easy way. So how to translate these Lagrangians, which depends on derivative of phi, into Lagrangian, which depends only on this extrinsic and curvature tensor. So this is, it's a bit technical, but this is how, which type of relations you need to make the translation. So essentially, you have to make the relation between the derivative of the scalar field and the normal vector. They are just proportional up to this normalization factor. Then you have the induced metric, which I already wrote down. And then you have to introduce extrinsic curvature tensor. And in the formula, you also have the acceleration. So the acceleration is just the variation, the covariant variation of the normal vector with respect to the normal vector. And for example, if you consider the covariant derivative of the normal vector, it will be a combination. So there will be two parts, a part which is purely in the three-dimensional world, which is the extrinsic curvature tensor, and a part which is halfway, which is given by this expression here. So now the key trick is just to replace the second derivative, because you see here that essentially you have two covariant derivatives acting on the scalar field. You have to replace the two covariant derivatives acting on the scalar field in terms of these ADM quantities. and this is the expression here. And you also need at some point to use the Gauss-Kodachi equation. So the Gauss-Kodachi are the relations between the three-dimensional curvature tensor and the four-dimensional curvature tensor. Well, so how to project the Riemann tensor to determine the three-dimensional curvature tensor. Okay, so let's see the result. So I'm going to skip the L2 because L2 is simply the K-essence case, which I've already treated. So let's go to L3. So L3 is given by this expression. So in fact, it turns out that this is convenient to introduce an auxiliary function, F3, which is defined by this equation here. And once you introduce this auxiliary function, you can very easily rewrite this Lagrangian in terms of the ADM quantities. So essentially, you find that you have some function times the trace of the extrinsic curvature tensor plus some other function of x and phi. So if you translate this into the EFT coefficients, you find that this term disappears. This term here disappears, and this term disappears as well. So you have only these four coefficients which are going to happen to occur in this model. So then let's go to the next one. So the next one is slightly more complicated, but you use the same recipes, and you find now that the Lagrangian will be a combination of the three-dimensional Ricci scalar plus a combination which involves the square of k and the square of k mu nu in this way. And the final term is simply linear in k, as in the previous case. So it turns out that if you go back to the quadratic Lagrangian, all terms which are wrote down are going to be non-vanishing in this case. But there is a restriction. The restriction is that, in fact, this coefficient, which appears in terms in front of the delta k square minus delta k mu nu delta k mu nu, is exactly the same as the coefficients which appear in front of this quantity here. Okay. So the last one is even more complicated, but you can once again apply the same recipes, and you find, so once again you find the same combination. So for the first, the second, so we had this already. Now there is something new which appears, which is a combination of the extrinsic curvature tensor and the intrinsic curvature tensor, which appears here. And then there is another combination which is going to involve cubic terms in the extrinsic curvature tensor. But here you can use a trick if you want to stop at quadratic order. Of course, if you want to go to third order, which is possible using this formalism, but if you want to stop at quadratic order to study linear perturbation, you see that this term which involves cubic terms in K can be re-expressed only in terms which involve square of the extrinsic curvature tensor up to a term which is cubic in the perturbations. Okay, so in practice, what we use, because we stop at the quadratic order, we replace this combination by this combination. So it turns out that from this expression, then you can work out all the coefficients in the expansion, and you find out that this is exactly the same result as the previous one. So in some sense, there is a degeneracy. And you find, once again, that all the operators which are wrote are present, and with the restriction that this M4 is equal to M4 tilde. OK. So now I'm going to go a bit further, because I would like now to make the connection with what people do when they want to confront any dark energy model with cosmological data. And usually people are not working in this very specific gauge where we have chosen this preferred slicing. So usually they prefer to work in another gauge, for example, in the Newtonian gauge. So it's convenient to know how to translate what I've written for the perturbations. So for example, in terms of zeta, to go into another gauge. So to go in another gauge means to modify the slicing. So the red slicing corresponds to my uniform scalar field slicing, but I would like to go to another slicing, which is a blue one, which will define the time of my new gauge, my new slicing. So obviously, what you have to do is just to shift, to have a shift in time, which depends on the spatial position. So essentially, you have to consider this transformation here to make a change of slicing. And this is so what is usually called now the Stueckelberg trick, which is to make a spatial dependent shift of time. And then you can re-express all the quantity which I use in my uniform scalar field slicing. I can translate into this new gauge, where now I'm going to see this new quantity, which is this pi quantity, which corresponds to the perturbations now, and which can be interpreted as the shift between the two slices. So note that what appears on the right, the three-dimensional quantity which are defined on the right, for example, the curvature tensor, are defined now with respect to the new slices, with respect to the blue slices. So then I can just go, for example, in the Newtonian gauge or in any gauge, and I can compute everything. So for example, I can write down the Einstein equations. So I've just given you as an example two equations which are very useful. So one is the generalized Poisson equation, which is written here. So you see that this equation is written in terms of all the coefficients which appear in this initial expansion up to second order. So here I'm using the EFT coefficients. But once again, there is an immediate dictionary between the EFT coefficients and the derivatives of the initial Lagrangian. And I've also written down the anisotropic equation. So this is the equation which in standard GR tells you that phi is equal to psi. So in this generalized context, you see that you have now more terms which appear. And of course, there is an equation for pi which I didn't write down. So I'm almost finished. So now the idea is to try to make a connection with quantity which we hope to observe in the future. And so one quantity which is very often used in the literature is the effective Newton's constant. So the effective Newton's constant is the relation between, so in fact this is a rewriting of the Poisson equation, of the relativistic Poisson equation, when you relate the gravitational potential phi to the co-moving density contrast, this delta M. And you see immediately that this effective Newton's constant can be computed from this expression, which is obtained. So here there is a simplification, an approximation, which is called the quasi-static approximation. So when you look at scales which are small enough with respect to the Hubble radius, in many cases you can ignore the time derivatives with respect to the spatial derivatives. So this is called the quasi-static approximation, and which means that all the equation can be written simply so you get rid of all the derivatives, for example, phi dot, psi dot, and so on, have disappeared, and you have only the phi, psi, and pi, with coefficients which depend on the time n on the scale, on k. And so you see immediately that you can compute from this matrix here, you can compute this effective Newton's constant. You can also compute another quantity which is often introduced, which is the ratio between the two gravitational potentials, which will be useful, for example, for the weak lensing observations. And once again, it can be determined from this matrix. So to conclude, so I've tried to present you a kind of unified treatment. So the idea is to have a very generic treatment. If you start with almost any Lagrangian which is based on a scalar field, you express it in ADM form, and then you just put the formulas in. So I have a mathematical code in you can just put your Lagrangian, and you derive all the quantities which are relevant immediately, in fact. So if you restrict yourself, if one restricts oneself to models as a first step, to models which lead to second-order equation of motion for linear perturbations, then they can be parameterized by seven functions. So three are involved in to describe the background here, this F, lambda, and C. And then there are four coefficients. You need only four coefficients to describe the linear perturbations. It turns out that in Hondesky series, we have shown that these two coefficients here are degenerate. So you always have this equality between M4 and M4 tilde. And to summarize the full motivation would be if you have on one side the theoretical models, you translate these theoretical models into an effective description. So you compute this quantity, these coefficients, and then you test these models, or you confront these coefficients directly with the observations. So you have a kind of intermediate description to connect observation and models. Okay, thank you.
So at the level of the original phi action you wrote down, the equality M4 and equals M4 tilde comes from imposing essentially second order equations of motion, right?
Yes.
So I was wondering.
No.
Comes from.
No. Okay, we impose that in the equation of motion for the linear perturbations, there are at most two derivatives.
Correct.
Okay, yes. So time derivative or special derivative. Yes. So here it's special derivatives, and we forbid higher special derivative.
And that implies this equality. Now, I was wondering, is there a way to motivate that equality directly at
no,
level?
Sorry. Well, so it does not imply this equality in this case. If you impose linear equation of motions for the linear perturbation with at most two derivatives, you get this expression, where M4 tilde can be different from M4. It's only in the context of Hondesky series that you have this extra constraint.
Sorry, are you making a distinction between linear versus non-linear?
Yes. Okay. So it's different because, you see, here the requirement is that this is second order to any in a non-linear way.
Yeah, but still you're expanding those Hondesky terms about a fairly generic background. So I would say that linear perturbations about a fairly generic background are equivalent to non-linear
yes,
field configurations in the original theory.
But in some sense, here our background is homogeneous and isotropic. So it's not a generic background.
I see what you mean. But still, it's a generic time-dependent background.
Yes.
But anyway,
yes.
So
yes.
My question in the sense was sort of just a curiosity. Is there a way to even start motivating this equality directly at the level of this effective theory written in these variables, delta k, delta g0, 0, etc.
You mean to, but yeah.
I mean, is there a special symmetry that arises when this equality is?
But no, I think this is the point. If you just look at it from the point of view of the effective theory before going to Hondesky, you don't find this equality.
Okay.
So, yes.
So, this very simple-looking equation, just kidding, has four arbitrary functions of time. And so
yes.
Your view is that observations
yes.
should be cast into this framework?
Yes.
The problem is that's like four potentials. So how far do you think observations can get to deal with a generalized framework like this? That's question one. Question
mm-hmm.
two, which is buried in here, but I'd like to get your impression of exactly how it's buried. When you take standard modified gravity.
What do you mean by
well,
standard?
Well, standard being an L of R.
F of R.
F
of R.
Lagrangian of
yeah.
gravity. Of
yes.
R, right? You do a conformal transformation, mm-hmm. and then it's a fifth force, and so then what happens is that there is this big response around density structures,
mm-hmm.
Which will have all sorts of nice features. So. How what I'm trying to get at is how I am interpreting the different terms that are appearing on, for example, explicitly what's the kind of generalized potential or whatever it is that's controlling the coupling to matter in that form.
Hmm.
And so it's really what the physical interpretations are. And given that, how you actually think one would proceed from observations into trying to construct these effective descriptions and whether or not there's a chance of really nailing anything.
Okay. Yes, so concerning the first question, so yes, ideally one observation should give us something which is Z dependent, so which would give some constraint in principle on this function. But then it's a bit complicated because everything somehow is hidden in this coefficient here, which I didn't write explicitly because they're a bit complicated. But essentially, this coefficient will be some fraction which involve this M4 tilde coefficient, so the coefficient which appears here. These ones, all these coefficients which appear in this D, DEF, with also with K dependence. So our goal now is to explore more in terms of observational consequence. So far what we have is, starting from a very generic point of view, we can make a connection between this coefficient which I wrote in the action, which are here, and this coefficient which appear here. And for example, if you have in mind f of r gravity, which is equivalent in some sense to a scalar tensor theory, it means that this effective Newton constant will be different here. So you would expect some gross factor which would be different. So it would be one type of signature of this.
So for example, somebody comes to you and says, I want to do a sweep of n-body runs based upon your general framework.
Mm-hmm.
What would you do? You tell them to use this G effective, and so they would be dependent on M inverse 1-3, or would it be much more complicated than that?
But at this stage, what we would like to do is to have a kind of generic way to write down, for example, the transfer function. So the transfer function, the evolution.
You're doing linear perturbation.
Yes, linear perturbation. So at this stage, we are only at the level of linear perturbation.
Yeah.
So another step would go to start to explore the nonlinear regime.
Well, but so the gravity is often nonlinear. I mean, it sort of nominally is,
yes.
But the point is that it's weak and it's a response
yeah.
function to complicated density. So it's probably okay to, anyway. It's just an interesting question about how you go from this. Given that the
yes,
theory
yes.
of dark energy is notoriously going to give us very little information
yeah.
when we go at it observationally,
yes. No, I agree.
Except for fifth force.
So yes, so the next step for us is really to understand better what would be the impact on observation, or how much could you extract from observation to constrain these parameters which appear in the effective theory. Yes.
Okay, we have one last question.
So just a comment really with regard to your first question, Dick, about how much you can extract from observations. There was a paper about a year ago by Amendola and others talking about the Horndesky-Lagrangian and these, like, however many free functions there are. And they said, you know, given maximal information from large-scale structure and weak lensing, et cetera, there's only some subset of those functions that you can ever hope to constrain. I don't know, there were like how many free functions? 4 or something? And certain number related to the background, and they reasoned that you can constrain like at most 2 of them or something like that.
And when you do constrain, what that really means is that you're doing something which is a very crude representation of the form of those functions. You'd never be able to get them with any accuracy in terms of a lot of points. It's just not the way that dark energy game is going to be able to be played, unfortunately.
Well, a first game would be just to assume that they are constant and to see what you can tell from observation.
But sure.
No, I mean, as this coefficient, you could assume that they are constant.
Okay, since that was not a question but a comment, we can have one very last one.
Yeah, regarding this, for instance, yeah, the first thing would be to assume that they are very slowly varying.
Yes.
For instance, that they vary on, I mean, on cosmological timescales. And for instance, if you have a single minimally coupled scalar field, I mean, our first theory of effective dark energy pointed out the fact that you will measure W, and the second parameter that is very interesting to measure is basically the speed of sound of perturbations. And for instance, I didn't see in the literature many papers, I mean, pointing out that this was very interesting. For instance, I mean, the speed of sound of perturbation is a very interesting parameter that you have in any models of dark energy, even in the simplest ones.
Yes, I agree that the speed of sound would be very interesting to constrain. Just one word concerning W. So the idea is a bit to disentangle the aspect of the background and the aspect of perturbation. So the idea of the formalism is to put on a separate footing the aspect of the background and the aspect of the perturbation. Yes, but then it becomes model dependent, the relation. So, yeah.
Okay, let's thank David again.